Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, our weekly unfiltered episode where me, Colin, Meethal, we like to discuss what's been in the news, what's been on our minds. Hi, guys. Welcome back from spring break.
Hey.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Or was I the only one on spring break?
Mine was earlier.
No. I was lucky enough to have two spring breaks. That's why I'm so discombobulated right now.
Lucky enough. That's great when kids are not in school at different times. Very convenient.
Mm-hmm. It's awesome. It's the best. I recommend it. Highly recommend.
Colin, when was your spring break? I don't remember.
Like March 7th-ish or something. We have it early at the law school.
That is,
it's very early.
That's still winter. Yeah. I'm sorry. That's like,
that's
you barely are over the holidays at that point. All right. Well, a lot's going on in the world. I'll go ahead and start because I've got an update. Did anybody else have an update?
I have an update as well.
You do? All right. Well, Meethal, you want to start?
I can start with my update, sure.
Okay, start with your update.
So my update is related to Nancy Guthrie. Mm. Surprisingly, she hasn't been found yet. However, Monday, TMZ reported that they received another ransom note. And this
wait,
is from...
Wait. When you say TMZ reported, TMZ did not get the ransom note.
They did. Right? Mm. They did.
They.
So if
not the family, but TMZ got... No, I don't remember another one.
So okay. In the beginning, when Nancy was first kidnapped in early Feb, TMZ got a couple ransom notes, and I think some other news sources got them. And the authorities were checking them out. They're like, man, it's not legitimate. So it kind of, you know, went away, and they started doing the rest of their investigation, other channels. On Monday, they reported they received another ransom note from the same person that had sent the previous ones, still requesting the Bitcoin and all that kind of stuff. And so what they're saying is Nancy is in Sonora, Mexico, and they are claiming to have information.
The kidnappers are saying that.
No, the person who sent the ransom note. They have information that stating that they know who took Nancy and they know where she is. Send me the Bitcoin and then I'll give you the information. So, I mean, we'll see if it's legitimate or not. Obviously, the authorities are looking into it. But that's new as of Monday. There's nothing else new. No results on any of the other leads in terms of, you know, the genealogy or...
Do you know why... Why was this person's communication, why were they dismissed in the past? Because I'm assuming they'd be dismissed for the same reason.
I mean, I guess they just didn't find it to be legitimate. Mm. I don't know if there was, you know, conflicting information in terms of like the address for the Bitcoin or details around what, but, and there are multiple, right? I think there were at least two or three different ransom notes in general that they had received in the beginning that the FBI basically just said it's not legitimate. And so they just put it by the wayside and carried on with their investigation.
Right. And also, tip to people who are trying to blackmail folks like this. I mean, you might want to show some evidence. You actually know something. Yeah. I don't know, proof of life.
Well,
and something.
What's crazy is they did like, two notes back to back on Monday itself. In one of them, they're claiming that Nancy's dead. And then in the other one, they're saying she may be dead. And so, you know, again, it's conflicting information, but it's maybe information nonetheless. They're saying they can give like exact coordinates of where she is. So we'll see. If something comes of that or not.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That was my update.
That's not going to get them their Bitcoin or anything, really, because there's just no evidence that they know anything. Yeah.
Right. This is the third month that we're going into now.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have an update and a story that I reported on a few weeks ago, and that was the death of the Nepali refugee Shah Alam. Remember, he was the blind man who had those curtain rods and stuff. And when we reported it, you know, it basically, like the body cam footage had come out showing, like, you know, everything that happened and how he had been tased and then he was taken in by the police and then he was turned over to ICE and then ICE left him out in the cold and then he was found deceased. So it was under investigation. Well, just recently, the Erie County Medical Examiner has ruled the death of this victim a homicide. Which can include death caused by negligence. So now that they've ruled that, I guess what we have to wait and see is if charges will ensue. So far, nobody's been charged. If it is been ruled a homicide, it seems like, and some charges should come, right? I mean, Colin, like, but these are federal officers, right? So then you've got like kind of what we talked about before, which is different kinds of immunity that might apply to them.
Right. Yeah. And that's going to lead to questions about qualified immunity for sure and whether they violated a clearly established right of this individual.
Yeah. Anyhow, I just wanted to update on that. I am glad to hear that they ruled it a homicide, whether this will result in any, I mean, if nothing else, maybe it'll allow the family to pursue some kind of civil damages. Is that possible, Colin?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mithal, how about we turn it over to you for your story,
sure.
And then we'll...
So my story is, apparently I'm still staying in Utah, no longer on the Corey Richens case, but this is another case about an 11-year-old boy by the name of Christopher. He allegedly had been bullying one of his classmates, a little girl. And according to the mother of that girl, Christopher, you know, had a history of bullying her children, including some of her children who have disabilities. And so, you know, despite raising her concerns to the school a number of times, she just felt that they weren't really doing anything about it. So one day she decided to handle the situation herself. Last September, Shannon Tifugo, the mother of the said bullied child, was driving around her neighborhood looking for Christopher, and she found him riding his bike. She stopped her car in front of him and made him get into the car. She told him she was going to take him to her house.
Oh my God.
So he could apologize to her child. And that was it. Obviously, he was scared, but he proceeded to get into the car and went to her house, ultimately apologized to her daughter. Tifugo also allegedly threatened to have her husband beat him up, but ultimately she just let him go. She wanted the apology for her daughter. He gave it. And then she's like, okay, get out of my house. He ran home, told his mom what had just happened, and she was understandably very disturbed. Christopher's mom, Amber Lee Collazo, said she's never met this woman and obviously would have expected her to just come and have a conversation with her if there was any bullying going on, so they could kind of figure it out amongst themselves and address it with their children. Collazo also said her side is, you know, for the last 2 years, that girl has been bothering my son, and supposedly she has a crush on Christopher. And so he, quote, got fed up with the fact that she doesn't leave him alone, and he rejected the girl with a rude comment. And so that rude comment is what led Shannon Tifugo, the mother, to step in and go looking for her. Fast forward to last week, and Shannon Tifugo was charged with second-degree felony child kidnapping and second-degree felony aggravated child abuse.
Ooh.
And she's due in court the end of this month. Now, her attorney released a statement denying the allegations and described the filing as, quote, a symptom of our own society's failings where children were once held accountable by their parents, unquote. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got a mom who believes she's addressing a bullying situation since the school, or in her mind, you know, the child's family is not holding the child accountable. And then on the other hand, you know, you've got Christopher's mother who's saying, that's not at all what's going on. This is just a girl with a crush and my boy was rude to her. But also, you could have just come and talked to me about it. You took my child off the streets.
Right.
And technically, she just wanted an apology. So, I mean, we'll see what comes of it. Again, she's not due in court until the end of the month. But, you know, Christopher's mother is saying, you know, now Christopher suffers from anxiety and emotional distress and is, quote, going to have trust issues with people for so long, unquote. So obviously he's also really disturbed. So, yeah. What do you guys think? Are you going to go kidnapping somebody that's bullying your kid? But it's just the difference of the stories, right? One says it's a crush. The other says that they're being bullied. So...
Well, first of all, can I say there's a clear and established pattern with the stories you bring to us, almost all of them, many of them, that involve, like,
yeah, I've noticed
is this
that.
Good or bad parenting? I feel like that's, like, the crux. Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah. I don't know, Colin, I saw you open your mouth, so I want to hear what you have to say first.
Well, I'm gonna, you know, to the point that you were just raising, is this bullying or is it unrequited love and that he's rebuffing her advances? But... that's kind of beside the point for me, which is it sounds like with this, rather than going to the parents and just explaining, here's the situation, to take the kid and bring him over and maybe even have the husband threaten to beat him up, I mean, that's, you can't do that. You know, this is different than the case we had earlier of the like 60 whatever year old man who got with the underage girl. There's a restraining order. Like here, there are other measures you can take before you're going to abduct this kid and bring him to your home. So I mean, I have sympathy for the general ideal of my kids are being bullied, I needed to act. But the way this was done, certainly inappropriate. Although, you know, felony charges might be a bit extreme.
Well, that's the thing. Like, does she deserve to go to jail for her approach?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with Colin on this in that, first of all, I think it doesn't it doesn't matter really what happened with the kids vis-a-vis like the charges and stuff and how she handled the situation. But I think the charges are ridiculous. I think they are absolutely insane. Felony charges? Come on. Look, I remember there was a kid who was bullying Yasin, my son, at the mosque. This happened a couple of years ago. They were like around, and it was, this kid was kind of a leader of like, he was kind of like the popular kid. So there's like a whole gang of kids that were following him. So if Yasin always wanted to go and hang out at the mosque, there's a big place to play outside, and he would take like his Legos, or he would take a remote control car, or he would take a scooter. And every single day, like, this kid would take his stuff. One time he took his money that he had gotten from our Eid holiday was like $150. The kid stole the $150. So this kept happening over and over. And then the kid would just like run off. And then I would ask Yasin, well, where is he? Who is he? Finally, one day he's like, that's him, right? This is like 5 or 6 days in. And I went straight up to the kid and I just leaned down in his face. And I said, if you ever take anything from my child or any other child again, I was like, I'm going to call the police on you. I know that was an awful thing to say to like a 9-year-old child, but this kid was a little thug, right? Now, I was like, where are your parents? He wouldn't tell me which one his parents were. And this is not uncommon because they're just kids running wild at mosques generally, and the parents are who knows where. So I can understand the frustration this woman might have had. You know what I mean? And it could be that she believed her daughter's story as well. This is what was happening. I can't imagine that if she had known that the daughter was like, well, he just said one insulting thing to me, that she would have gone to such measures. That's the kind of thing a parent will do, I think. They'll just snap when the kid's constantly being like picked on and stuff. So I get how the parent felt. Is it really kidnapping, though, if she asked him to get in the car and he did on his own?
I guess not if he did it on his own, right? It's not like
he could have been like, I'm on my bike. Middle finger, I'm driving home. Yeah. I'm like, what are you going to do?
You might need some details there about how willing or unwilling he was to get in and how much pressure she put on him, but I think it would depend on the circumstances.
And that would be also a he said, she said situation as well. So, you know, I mean, I think the charges are nuts. Do I think what she did was right? No. Do I think 25, 30 years ago this would have been handled without the police involved? Yes. And sometimes we just need to go back to the good old days and let the parents duke it out. And put it to rest.
Well, and again, like, you know, Shannon is saying that this has been going on for a couple of years, and it's not just bullying this kid. She must have multiple kids, and I don't know how many or if only one or multiple kids have a disability, but I think it's the accumulation, right? Clearly she's raised it as a concern multiple times. And if it does have to do with Christopher bullying a child that has disabilities, well, obviously the school has to do something about that. Do they need to bring the authorities in, you know, and take it to the cops? I don't have all that detail. That's not out there yet. But nonetheless, like, you can't just...
I'm sure you must have experienced your kids being bullied at some point, right?
No, of course, of course. Yeah. But at the same time, all she wanted was an apology for her child, ultimately, right?
Yeah.
It's not like they were physically fighting or anything like that. So if all you wanted was for him to apologize, there were so many easier ways of going about getting that.
Mm.
Yeah. You know? Whether it's talking to the child directly, right then and there, she could have been like, tomorrow when you go to school, you're going to apologize to my child.
And I don't think, I'm guessing she wasn't like stalking him. She probably was driving down the street. She's like, oh, there's rat bastard.
Exactly. I guess she just kind of reached her limit. She's like, she like cut him off or whatever and was like, get in the car. You're going to go apologize to my child.
Yeah. Listen, I get it, Mom. I've been there. I am ashamed of what I said to that 9-year-old, but I get it. Yeah. All right. Well, let's see how this goes down. Will this be another case of the state setting an example, right? Like, and holding parents accountable to a standard that I think is kind of crazy. Colin, I'm going to pass it on to you. What do you got for us this week?
Yeah, I have a story that I kind of see as this interesting clash between the world that used to be and the world that we've entered now. And it takes us all the way back to the founding of this country, as well as the nationalization and the increasing interconnectedness, and this question of what right to privacy we still have and what courts are going to find after this opinion that I deal with. And so, right, if we go back to the Bill of Rights, we have the Fourth Amendment. It protects citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's based upon this old practice of general warrants in England before the country is founded. And then after the Fourth Amendment, we have states across the country in their own constitutions enshrining some type of right to privacy. And so that's the 18th century. Fast forward to World War I. And at the end of World War I, we have the origins of the first fast food franchise in this country, and that is A&W. And so
Okay, I didn't see this plot twist coming. Where is this story going?
this is a post-World War I parade. It's held in California, and this guy, Roy W. Allen, sets up a stand to offer root beer to the veterans. Eventually, he partners with his employee, Frank Wright, and they found A&W Restaurant, which, of course, we mostly know for A&W Root Beer, but it's a franchise. There are over 900 locations around the world. And so the story of A&W is this, the story of nationalization and franchising and the ways in which eventually we have the internet. And again, this question of what privacy remains in the world. And so all of this takes us then to this case out of Oregon leading to this recent ruling by the state Supreme Court. And so we have this individual. His name is Randall DeWitt Simons. And this is in Western Oregon. It's the county that borders the ocean. And Mr. Simons goes to an A&W restaurant in Oregon. And on his cell phone, he accesses the Wi-Fi network at A&W, and allegedly he is accessing child porn. And so the A&W restaurant gets flagged. There is suspicious activity that this guy is accessing on your Wi-Fi, and they contact the local authorities. And they work with the local authorities who monitor when he comes into the A&W, and they track him accessing this child pornography. And he is ultimately convicted of offenses connected to child pornography. And he appeals, and he says, even on the public Wi-Fi of A&W, I have the right to privacy. And the A&W, in effect, became a state actor when they worked with the authorities. And the state needed to get a warrant if they wanted to track my behavior on the Wi-Fi network. And so this wound its way up ultimately to the Supreme Court of Oregon, which recently issued its opinion. And I'm going to read from the opinion regarding their finding that he had a right to privacy in the A&W and a warrant was required. So they wrote, participation in the modern world virtually requires access to the internet. The Supreme Court has observed that internet-enabled smartphones are such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life that carrying them is indispensable to participation in modern society. Our physical and virtual lives are lived simultaneously. Nearly every member of society, young or old, rich or poor, housed or unhoused, will use the internet to conduct what they intend to be private business. Indeed, in many cases, they must do so. In our age of paperless billing and cloud-based storage, health records are accessed and finances are managed online. On most days, many, if not most, Oregonians will find themselves in a location serviced by a Wi-Fi network, and there are legitimate reasons, both financial and technological, to use those networks. Even without economic incentives to connect to Wi-Fi, users may nevertheless elect to connect to various public Wi-Fi hotspots throughout their day because of the pragmatic advantages of doing so. Connecting to available Wi-Fi can provide higher speed for internet browsing. It can provide a more stable internet connection. It can compensate for poor cell phone reception. And so there have been earlier courts that have found you don't have a right to privacy when accessing something like A&W's Wi-Fi. This could be a major ruling. Supreme Court of Oregon, obviously very liberal. And that's the question going forward. When we have John and Jane Doe going to A&W or McDonald's or the local library, and they're accessing the Wi-Fi network, do they have a right to privacy? Supreme Court of Oregon says they do. What do you two think? Not the most sympathetic defendant you hear downloading child pornography, but should we have a right to privacy when we're using the Wi-Fi of a restaurant?
Yeah, I feel like every time I'm in a public place at a Panera or wherever, you know, and you're trying to access the Wi-Fi, there's all this, like, you got to check all these boxes about, like, your usage. You're agreeing to certain kinds of usage. Look, admittedly, I've never read them. I just check the box and move on. But isn't that one way for, like, these restaurants, or don't they have anything built in to say that you cannot use, like, your access, your Wi-Fi access here for certain kinds of browsing and certain, right? I mean, like, I feel like that's, like, built into it, but maybe I'm making that
up. Looking at the terms of service.
Yeah.
Must not transmit various materials. They don't restrain or restrict access. They may block, remove, etc. I think the point is that he wasn't uploading it. He was downloading it. And so I guess under the terms of service,
he was consuming it and they were surveilling it.
If he were uploading it, that would be different. But they're finding if he's just accessing the child pornography in the A&W, he has a right to privacy and the state needs a warrant.
Oh, I think that is an awful precedent.
It's awful for this case, but is it awful for other cases?
I feel like when you're in a public place and you're connecting them to their Wi-Fi, it's public. Like, it's not private. It's not secure anyways, regardless of what you're accessing, number one. Number two.
Yeah, that's true. There's that too.
You're not supposed to access child porn anyways. So no matter where you are, you should get caught, even if you're in your house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the way you're doing it, right? But the point, but I guess that's what it is, like fruit of the poisonous tree type of thing, right? Like, it's just the way that they actually obtained the evidence that he's doing this is the problem.
But that's a public place.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we take another case and someone is doing a financial transaction and the police are using that to claim wire fraud or something.
Yeah.
Does he have a right to privacy in that case? No. The court's saying, yes, he does, because the necessity of using these Wi-Fi networks when we're out in public.
I'm surprised, though, because to me, if you're in a public place, if I go to the library and access their Wi-Fi, it is a public place. Their internet access, their Wi-Fi is also public. It's not, you know, secure in that sense. And I think a lot of their terms and conditions state,
if anybody owns it, it's the library that owns it, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I always think when I access public Wi-Fi that I'm taking a risk, right? I'm not going to be putting in, like, during that time, I'm not going to be making purchases online, because I don't want to put in my credit card information or any kind of, or I won't even log into my Gmail or anything like that, because I don't want that somehow being, you know, picked up or saved or logged on this public Wi-Fi. So, you know, I don't know. But I know, Colin, you said that, okay, for this case, it's a bad precedent. For other cases, like, in what case do you think it would be good precedent? I mean, protecting people who are stupidly using public Wi-Fi?
Well, look, obviously, in this case, there's strong reason to believe that he is accessing child pornography.
Yeah.
As the opinion notes, this person could be accessing their health information. They could be doing financial transactions. They could be looking up things that to them are benign, but end up looking nefarious, right? Imagine someone is looking up a shovel to do some gardening and someone is killed with a shovel and the state is trying to use these internet searches to show, we believe they were looking for a shovel to use as the murder weapon. You know, any number of cases where someone claims I was doing a benign internet search and it was turned into.
But the thing is this, but the difference is this. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm a suspect in a case, right, and the police take my device to see what I've been searching, regardless of what, you know what I mean? They can search my device regardless of whatever Wi-Fi I'm using.
But they need a warrant unless it's like a search
incident
to a lawful arrest or something, right? That's the point here, is not to say the state can't do this. It's just they need a warrant if they want to access A&W's Wi-Fi.
Maybe I'd be more comfortable with this opinion if it was like, you do not have a right to privacy using a public network if you are using the network to commit a crime.
I mean, that would be a fair rule, I think. Yeah.
I mean, like, how about that? If you're doing it for like, you know, whatever your person, just whatever benign reasons, right? Then okay, there's a right to privacy to a certain extent. But again, it's, you're taking a risk, and it'll tell you that, by the way, your computer will sometimes send you a little pop-up. Be careful, you're on a public server,
Well,
whatever.
exactly. I think in general, rule of thumb, if you're on a public Wi-Fi, whether you're at A&W, at the library, at a college, university, like whatever, you shouldn't expect privacy. But also, no matter where you are in the world, even if you're in your home, if you're looking up child porn, you need to get caught.
Yeah. And that was actually the case that I found mainly. It was a case out of Pennsylvania where the defendants were on a college campus and they were using the college's Wi-Fi. And the Superior Court of Pennsylvania found they did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy when using the campus's Wi-Fi. And so this creates this split among the courts that I think eventually, I'm sure the Supreme Court will have to resolve.
What do you think the Supreme Court is likely to say on an issue like this?
I
States
mean, I.
rights, they're going to punt it back to the state.
No, I mean, I think they will rule. And I think that they're going to find there's not a reasonable expectation of privacy because so much of the modern Fourth Amendment precedent by the Supreme Court is about physical intrusions, like placing something on a car to track its movements. Whereas here, there's nothing physically accessed by the state. They're simply accessing the Wi-Fi network of the A&W. So I think if it reaches the Supreme Court, it'll probably be like a 6-3 opinion, I would guess, finding there's not a right to privacy. But we'll see. You never know.
So I'm guessing in this case, the state is going to appeal this up, right?
Actually, they can't because it was based upon the Oregon state constitution, so it didn't have
Oh,
federal
there's no,
grounds,
okay.
and the prosecution just announced they're dismissing the case against him because
Oh
the only
my
evidence they
God.
have is the Wi-Fi network. Yeah, so.
Well, he's in their targets. I mean,
Right.
they're gonna find him one way or the other doing the same thing somewhere. But I mean, like, I guess in my imagination, I'm like, I don't want to go to a Panera or go to a Starbucks, or whatever, and have like people sitting around me doing all kinds of, or even watching, forget child porn, just any, you know, I don't, you know what I mean? Because it's, you can't, it's not private when it's everybody's eyes can be on it. My kids can walk past it. It's just, I don't know.
Well, here's a question to follow up. You know, let's say, Rabia, you are at the A&W or the McDonald's and you're accessing Wi-Fi and you're doing it to look at messages between your attorney and yourself. Do you lose attorney-client privilege because you're accessing that in the fast food restaurant?
Again, the way I would come down on this is saying I'm not doing anything that's illegal, criminal. I'm not, you know, there's no commission of a crime here. So I think in a situation like that, yes, it should be private. But here's the thing. It should be, but I think it's fair for it not to be. Because again, every time we use a public network, we all should be aware that it's not, it's public. Like, you use it with that expectation. That's why, like I said earlier, I'm careful when I'm using a public network. You know, I don't use it for things that are sensitive or confidential, generally speaking. Okay, interesting.
But I doubt most people think that way. You know what I mean? Like, you would think that most people are like, oh, I'm in a public place, even though I have access to this Wi-Fi, like, I'm only going to look at certain things that are not as confidential versus you as a user who's going to be like, I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z because of where I'm located and what I'm how I'm connecting.
I mean, when I most people I see working on public Wi-Fi, at least, I don't know, in the afternoon, like they're just trying to put together their the presentations for work or some crap. Like, it's usually some kind of work-related stuff. And yeah, even that can be sensitive and confidential sometimes, but you take that risk, I think. You take that risk. Here's my story. And this is not on brand for me in terms of how stories go, but I want to start off by saying I have always been very proud to not be a conspiracy theorist. Okay. From 9/11 onwards, UFO stuff, I'm just like, whatever. I've always just, I'm like, nope. Even a level of arrogance, I would admit that I don't believe in this stuff. The last couple of years has changed me. It's worn me down. I'm like, all kinds of things are true that I never expected could be true. So having said that, I fell accidentally down a very little rabbit hole just for maybe about 20 minutes or so about UFOs. Okay. Now here's the thing. And the rabbit hole I fell down was because I saw a video interviewing Representative Tim Burchett. I think Burchett is how his last name is said. He's from Tennessee. And the video had him, it had Matt Gaetz, it had a couple different, you know, basically government officials talking about how they had been briefed on, you know, by the Pentagon. There's been hearings held in Congress on like UFO research and whatever. But they've been had briefings that were like confidential briefings. And, you know, this rep was like, if the American public knew what we had been told, like it would be absolute panic, like insanity. He's like, you know, I think Trump should release the information. Although I'm like, you know what, just leave it alone. There's enough for us to deal with. We don't need to know. But the story is not about that. That story led to something else the same representative said. And he said, you know, these briefings he's been getting probably are tied into like these disappearances and this weird stuff that's happening with all these scientists. I don't know. Have you guys heard this story? But all these scientists. Okay. So in the last couple of years, there is a growing list of scientists, American scientists, all of them linked to very sensitive government research who have either died or disappeared since about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Okay. Whether or not they're connected is unclear. The deaths might not be, but I'm going to go into like each one of these cases briefly. Okay. So the disappearances, though, are the things that are like making my antenna stand up. Okay. So the first one kind of included in this group, and by the way, MSN has reported on this. So I'm not like pulling this off of like kind of, you know, random dark web websites. MSN has reported on this, and there's been a lot of high profile coverage of it actually. This starts off in July of 2024 with the death of a man named Frank Maywald, and he was a senior scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, okay? Here's the thing about his death. Nobody has any idea why he died. There was an obituary that did, he was only 61, excuse me. He died in California. And his obituary just said that, you know, there was no cause of death ever. It just said that he dedicated many years to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. His expertise and leadership were instrumental. He was a lead researcher on breakthroughs that could help future space missions detect clear signs of life on other worlds. Okay, now, I'm going to lay out all these dots. You can connect them as you want. Okay, so this guy dies. We have no reason why. Just a sudden death. There's never been a cause of death. And I believe there... And no autopsy was performed on him, okay? Then, not too long ago, just... Although this one is kind of explained, but again, because now I am a conspiracy theorist, I wonder if the explanation is sufficient. This past February, an astrophysicist by the name of Carl Grillmeyer, he was involved in NASA's, a number of NASA projects. He worked at a NASA-supported space telescope project and infrared systems, and he was shot and killed at his home. Apparently, like, he was... somebody was captured, okay? They said this guy had stolen his car, but also, like, you know, broken into the house and confronted the victim, Grillmeyer, and shot him to death. Okay. The problem is that there is no known motive. There's no connection between these guys. Could it be a completely random act of violence? Yeah, sure, it could. But anyhow, just, you know, data point. Then, about a year before that, nuclear fusion researcher Nuno Loureiro opened his door, and he was shot and killed by Claudio Valente, who was the same man who 2 days earlier, on December 13th of 2025, had done the Brown University mass shooting. You might remember that in December of 2025. 2 days later, he shows up. There was a manhunt for him. He shows up at Loureiro's house. Loureiro opens the door. He shoots him to death. Again, this guy is a nuclear fusion researcher, also connected to a lot of this other research and work that's being done by these other scientists. So those are the deaths. But here are, whether or not they're connected, I don't know. But here's the disappearances. And I think this is like the really crazy shit. Let's start with Monica Reza. Last June, she went missing. She was out hiking with friends in California. She had two experienced companions who were with her. She somehow got separated has never been seen since. Okay. She was a fellows material science and engineering expert at Aero Rocketdyne. She worked on all kinds of projects that brought her closely into the orbit of a general who also has disappeared. I'm going to talk about him in a second. And all of this, all of her research was related to like space stuff, reusable space vehicles and weapons. And I mean, all of these scientists had something to do with space, basically. So she disappears, right? There's a Facebook page that is dedicated to finding her. There's like, there's been just nothing, nothing. Then around the same time, that happened in June 2026. A year before that, a woman by the name of Melissa Casius, who worked at the Los Alamos National Laboratory with her husband, completely disappears. That morning around 6:15 a.m., June 26th, she drives her husband to work. They work at the same place. And she says, oh, I forgot my work badge. And she goes back home. Then she disappears. But she is seen on surveillance footage a couple of hours later walking on the freeway. And that's it. So she's seen for a little bit walking on the freeway. There's no other footage of her. Her car is at home. Her keys, her work cell phone, her wallet, her personal cell phone, her purse, her money, everything she's left behind. Her phones are reset to factory settings. And that's it. The last she's seen is on the surveillance footage walking away, and she's never seen again. All right. Another guy, Anthony Chavez. He was also connected to Los Alamos National Labs. He also disappeared during a walk. No signs, no answers. He worked at a high-security nuclear lab, and he was tied to nuclear weapons research. He, in May 2025, so this is about a month or so before Casius, he goes for a walk. He leaves his car locked in the driveway, does not take his wallet, keys, any personal items. And he just goes for a walk, and he has never been found since. Gone, okay? He's in his 70s, disappeared. Now, most recently, retired Air Force General William McCasland, who I talked earlier about, a couple of the other folks, in fact, have done projects that were under this general's, like, in his purview. He was, he often went out for walks by himself. He's a retired Air Force general. He was the one who was funding one of the projects that Monica Reza was working on, who disappeared last year. She said that, and this is how I got to this case, was because of McCasland's story that the representative talked about, because McCasland worked on stuff related to this, like whatever was happening inside the Pentagon on UFO information. Okay. He also basically just went out apparently for a walk. He was last known to be near his residence in the area of Quail Run Court, out in New Mexico. All these things are happening like out in that area, and everything's left at home once again. Cars, keys, wallet, cell phones, everything is left at home, and he's never seen again. This just happened. Now, his wife, her name is Susan McCasland Wilkerson. She posted a very long note on Facebook, and she said, quote, yes, he did have ties with the UFO community, but not any special knowledge about the ET bodies and debris from Roswell crash stored at Wright Pratt. Though at this point, with absolutely no sign of him, maybe the best hypothesis is that aliens beamed him up to the mothership. However, no sightings of mothership hovering above the Sandia Mountains have been reported. His wife actually wrote that, which is kind of weird. Of course, there's all these conspiracy theories and theories emerging online, and some have said, oh, maybe like there's some connection to Nancy Guthrie, but there's no reason for there to be a connection. So, you know, what do I say? Even his glasses. He even left his glasses at home. Okay. All of these people have ties. And by the way, you know, folks are paying attention to this. And even as a representative was talking about this, he made sure to say during his interview, and he's given numerous interviews. By the way, I will never hurt myself. I have no intention of disappearing. You know, making sure that if something happened to him, it means it wasn't of his own volition. There's a Missouri Republican, Eric Burleson, who says the disappearance of multiple scientists, he wrote this on X, the disappearance of multiple scientists and military personnel with ties to advanced research is deeply concerning. I have requested FBI involvement, and we will keep pressing for answers. Okay. That's my story. All these people connected to research, a lot of them connected to research, having to do with proving whether or not there's life out there, or making contact with it, or overseeing programs, or fund, or one of the, I think Monica Reza was the one who, she developed an alloy, that was like critical to this stuff. But these are all definitely people who know a lot and maybe know too much, is what I'm trying to say. And yeah, I don't know. Thoughts?
I mean, it's wild for sure. It's hard. It's hard to ignore, like, the similarities between these disappearances and, you know, their connections or whatever. But, like, where are they or who took them? You know, it's mm-hmm. wild. I'm not big on conspiracy theories either necessarily, but yeah, it's hard to ignore this.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, with Monica Reza, okay, she's out hiking. These are monstrously huge national parks. It does happen. Hikers do disappear. She was apparently an experienced hiker. It was the daytime. But the one, like, for example, Melissa Cassius, I mean, she leaves everything at home. She goes home to get her badge and then leaves everything, puts her phone to factory settings, and just walks away. Like, what compels a person to do that? Is she being picked up by somebody and, like, take it into witness protection? It's like, you know, what's happening? Or was she forced to do that under threat, under duress, right? Threat of her life, threat of her family's life. And then she's actually hurt somewhere. And this retired general. I mean, it's all wild. Your glasses? First of all, every time I've heard of a true crime story in which, like, a husband calls the police and says, I don't know, my wife was not, her purse is here and her car is here and everything's here, but maybe she went out for a walk. No, he's lying. Something went very wrong. You know, nobody's doing that.
Especially if they're going for a walk without their phone, you know, if nothing else, right? I mean, glasses, maybe you don't need that for a walk. I don't know. But also, like, I don't know. It's wild. Like, the factory reset, why would you do that? I could buy into the I know too much personally, and so I'm gonna disappear myself to spare my family, or, you know, if it's something like that. Or I don't think, do you remember Mork and Mindy? Remember that show?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like
Nanu Nanu.
Yeah. Like, I mean, are they, like, talking about aliens from another planet and they know about them? And
yes, they are. This video of Matt Gaetz, who I think is absolute a nut job anyways and a horrible human being. But he's like, listen,
yeah,
we were briefed. I don't think he's just making this up out of whole cloth. He's like, we were briefed about a program in which they've captured, I don't know who the they are, but whoever that they are, have captured some of these extraterrestrial beings and are trying to crossbreed them with human beings that they have abducted from, like, refugee camps. I mean, it was a whole thing. And I'm like, I mean, is that a bad drug trip, or is he actually? But he's not saying, I mean, others have said things that look, there is something is there. We don't, like, we've been briefed on it. It is real, but the public doesn't know about it. So do I think at this point, yes, that extraterrestrial beings, 100%, I think it's a real thing. I don't know if any of these, but I feel like, Colin, what do you think? It feels like too much to be a coincidence with this many cases.
I mean, you probably can guess my point of reference for this, which is movie news. And that's, I heard, I think semi-recently, and this happened, I think, back in 2023, there was this guy, David Grush, who's, like, claiming to be the UFO whistleblower, who says the government has these spacecraft and bodies, and they've been studying them for years. And so I don't know exactly what Grush testified to, but he's serving as a consultant for a UFO movie that will be directed by Joseph Kaczynski, who directed Top Gun Maverick and F1, so if this movie comes to fruition, it's going to be a huge Hollywood blockbuster. It's described as All the President's Men with UFOs. And so I have no idea.
We got to wait for the movie to find out the truth, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know about everything you're going into here, but Do I think it's quite possible that there is alien life out there and there are UFOs? Absolutely. I just don't know enough about any of this to be able to comment intelligently, yeah, other than I'm looking forward to this movie. I know Steven Spielberg has a Disclosure Day coming out this summer, which is also a UFO movie, which I'm looking forward to. But I hope this Kaczynski one comes to fruition.
I mean, yes, if that's the only way we can get to some of this information, or maybe Iran could make a Lego movie about it, as they have been doing about every other thing, and tell us what's really going on. I'm sure they've got access to these files as well. Look, I UFOs or no UFOs, I'm like, if I was anybody working with any significant knowledge in that space, I'm sure I at this point would be worried as well. And the other thing is this, and this is another possible explanation, that it doesn't necessarily mean that, for example, they're being disappeared by their own government because they know too much. It could be that they know enough that other governments and other, like, you know what I mean? Like people who are adversaries to us might be like, we need this. We need your knowledge. We want, you know, your information. And so who knows where they are? The fact that there are no bodies found, there's no way to trace them because they've left behind their credit card. I mean, like, who walks? Okay, maybe these guys went for a walk. Cassius wasn't going for a walk. She's walking down the freeway.
Yeah.
You know, there's something going on. Anyhow, that's my true crime story for the week. Like I said, not on brand, but I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one here who believes that there are extraterrestrial beings out there at this point. 10 years ago, you couldn't have gotten me to say that.
Well, I mean, you think about it, like going back to Colin and movies, all these sci-fi movies and shows, like, yes, people are very creative, but a lot of that stuff still has some truth to it, right? Like, you know, that's how it comes about.
I mean, well, look, my understanding always was like, you know, they're getting their ideas of like aliens and UFOs from all these people who've had alleged sightings over hundreds of years, really, right? And then people in different parts of the world describing them all looking very similar, like, you know what I mean? And so they use that and then they run with it. But I do know this, that when those hearings were going on in Congress, that repeatedly there were pilots who testified that they had seen absolutely inexplicable flying objects, like, you know, like appearing right outside of the cockpit, right? Like, and then disappearing, massive objects at speeds they had never seen, or they were just, so those, they're coming from somewhere. You know, all these very professional, completely rational military folks are not getting up there and testifying under oath and making that stuff up. So anyhow, look, this is not supposed to be at the UFOs. This is supposed to be about the missing people. That's the true crime angle here that I'm trying to make the case for. All right, I guess that's it for us. Anything else you guys want to add before we wrap up?
Nanu, nanu.
That's the best way to end this. All right, guys, have a good week. See you next week.
Bye.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.